Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from Wisconsin Eye's Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review.
Hello, Wisconsin!
President Biden stumps a Racine with an economic message. Joint Finance agrees to spend $36 million on opioid issues. And the Joint Audit Committee voted 6-4 to conduct a DEI audit of state agencies. All that plus WIS Politics Stock Picks on Rewind, your week in review from May 10th.
I'm J.R. Ross.
I'm Jesse Opoyan.
And welcome to Rewind. Jesse, first off, thanks for filling in while Emily's on vacation this week.
Glad to be here.
Big announcement, I think, this week. Joe Biden in Racine, sort of an actually, talk about Microsoft. $3.3 billion investment in artificial intelligence data center. So here are the rundowns of what's going on. So we've got the artificial intelligence data center. We have a data center academy to train 1,000 for the data center and STEM roles by 2030. A manufacturing-focused AI innovation lab at UW Milwaukee. And the White House says this will create 2,300 union construction jobs and 2,000 permanent jobs over time. So first off, Jesse, let's listen to U.S. Rep. Brian Stile and President Joe Biden talk about this project and who maybe should get credit for it.
Microsoft's announcement of private sector jobs in Racine is good for workers, and it's all the more important when workers and families find themselves falling further and further behind. He's coming here today to take credit for private sector work that began over 10 years ago. The new jobs in Racine County, that's a win for workers and is absolutely essential at a period of time of high inflation when families are falling further and further behind.
It's all part of Microsoft's broad plan to build an artificial intelligence ecosystem right here in Racine. And it's going to be transformative. It means folks are getting trained. Folks are getting trained in new, high-paying, high-skilled jobs that don't require a four-year college degree and don't require you to leave home. The bottom line is, we're doing what's always worked in this country, giving people a fair shot, leaving nobody behind, and grow the economy in the middle out and the bottom up, not the top down. When that happens, everybody does well.
Now, Jesse, this is not Foxconn 1.0, right? Foxconn 1.0 is supposed to be a $10 billion plant, 13,000 jobs, Wisconsin Valley, you know, the eighth wonder of the world, but it's still a pretty big deal for especially what Mount Pleasant did to clear the property for Foxconn. What I'm curious about, though, is why is it such a big deal? Who should get credit for this?
Well, if it's a success, everyone wants the credit, right? And if it's a failure, maybe we shy away from that. But no, I mean, I think it was interesting hearing Republicans talk about this because they, you know, really wanted to make clear that this is a positive announcement for the area. They're happy about the jobs, but they don't think that Joe Biden deserves any credit for it. They also didn't want to necessarily talk a ton about Foxconn other than to acknowledge, like you said, that, you know, a lot of that groundwork, a lot of that infrastructure that came through for the Foxconn development really, you know, forgive the phrase, paved the way for this. But, you know, they see this as, I think, Biden coming in and hijacking it, whereas, you know, for Biden, it's kind of trolling Donald Trump, you know.
Well, to that point, yeah. I mean, they kept hitting on Foxconn. Like, my predecessor promised this. The line about the golden shovels, they dug a hole and fell in, trying to tweak Donald Trump. But this is a guy who makes promises and can't follow through with them. But I also thought it was interesting, this whole thing, is that this project probably doesn't happen if we're Alabama or if we are Wyoming. We are one of four or five states that matter. Probably didn't hurt. Also, if you, to me, in talking to people about the debate, who gives credit, like I saw some people like thanking Scott Walker. Mm-hmm. I don't think Walker's why this happened in Wisconsin. Also, you can't ignore that if this land hadn't been cleared and the infrastructure wasn't there, it's not ready-made for Microsoft. Also, Republicans saying, well, Joe Biden deserves no credit. Well, Brad Smith said, if it weren't for the CHIPS Act or the Inflation Reduction Act, we wouldn't have these programs that encourage us to do this. So it seemed like everybody gets a piece of it. But again, I think the fact that we are Wisconsin, once again, is probably why we benefited. And the trolling again is fascinating because it seems like Biden now is on a trolling streak with Trump, trying to like get under his skin. I don't know if it will work between in a debate, but they seem to want to irritate him as much as they possibly can. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, it seems like that. I mean, he's a guy who can't necessarily help himself from speaking up when he feels like he's been slighted, so I'm sure they're trying to poke the bear and get him to say something. But, you know, like you said, there's always been the debate, right, over, you know, who's responsible for job creation. Is it governors? Is it presidents? And it's just the answer is it's a lot of mixes, a lot of mixed moving parts, and a lot of carryover from one administration to another.
So, speaking of visits from the White House, Kamala Harris back in Wisconsin again. I believe this is her fourth visit this year. Going to be Milwaukee next week. So, why? The theme is the Economic Opportunity Tour, but why do you think she's coming back to Wisconsin so soon after the last visit?
I mean, I think they're not going to stay away, right? you know, I think they're taking advantage of the fact that Donald Trump is also tied up in court quite a bit right now, and so they can contrast that he's been here twice, and you know, they're going to be here, you know, in the double digits pretty soon, probably. I don't think they're going to stop coming here. We can go back to 2016 again and remind ourselves of Hillary Clinton and, you know, pretty much ignoring the state. And I think they're going to overcorrect on that a little bit this year. I don't know that we're going to be able to get rid of them.
I saw something, I think maybe the Cook Report, talking about the states that matter this fall, and that their operatives talking about that. Those Sun Belt states that Biden won in 2020, Nevada, Georgia, Arizona, they're not real likely this fall right now, yeah. Right now, as we sit here at this very moment.
Right.
Also, Biden's talking about maybe North Carolina, maybe Florida because of the abortion initiative. Trump's trying to say that Virginia, Minnesota are in play. It seems like reality is it's Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania. It's the blue wall once again, so it seems like that's why we're going to be here, seeing them time and time and time again. So now to stuff actually happened in the Capitol this week. So opioid settlement money. We are now 3-for-3, Jesse. Joint Finance Committee has reworked the Evers administration plan 3 times for the funds. The first few times they've gotten it. On the screen, you'll see what was cut, essentially, the big cuts. $5 million for DHS's Family Resource Center proposal, $5 million for programs to train peer support specialists. Joint Finance added $4.7 million for capital projects. I think they boosted that around almost $7.7 million. They added $3 million for medication-assisted treatment. They added $2 million more for law enforcement grants. Push that, I think, to $3 million. And all I counted, about $15.5 million moved around with this committee. Is this just they can't help themselves? Like, Republicans can't let the Evers folks do what they want to do with it. So they have to have their imprint on it.
I mean, I'm sure there's an element to that, too. But I think you and I were talking earlier about sort of the differences in philosophy, right, about how, you know, what they see as effective and what they see as useful spending. So, you know, wanting to see kind of result-proven, approaches.
I'll be shocked if I see a joint finance motion opioid money doesn't put more money on law enforcement than what the Evers folks do. So that's just, like, philosophically their point. Like, they believe these are measurable things. Like, they can measure houses built or places renovated. They can measure Narcan doses handed out. That's more in their wheelhouse than prevention, education. That, yes, they want to see some of that, but they want more kind of tangible measurable things. Now, that's what happened in joint finance. What did not happen in joint finance was the governor's special meeting call. Again, 3-for-3. He's called 3 special meetings of joint finance. All 3 times they've ignored him. This is the second time, though, he's called a special meeting on the standoff over PFAS funding and hospital access. So remember, $125 million put in the budget for PFAS funding, $15 million for hospital stuff. There was supposed to be trailer legislation to, like, basically release the money, right? The $125 million is hung up because there was a bill written that Republicans said, this is our plan, Governor Evers. And Governor Evers said, I don't like your plan. If you pass it, I'll veto it. They said, you better not veto our plan. This is our plan. And he vetoed it. Now they don't like what he did. So we were at a standoff. Let's listen real quickly to Tip McGuire and Howard Markling talk about where we're at with the PFAS funding and why things are where they are. Let's listen to it right now.
What we're requesting right now is simply to release the money that can be used to address PFAS. I don't know. They've allocated these funds. We're asking for those funds to be released. I don't understand what would be a compromise within that. There is no bill that is required to allow for the release of these dollars. They can release these dollars today, and then those dollars can go towards helping to address PFAS in Wisconsin.
We're not holding anything up. The governor vetoed those bills, and Co-Chair Boren and I sent a letter to the governor last month, and we were pretty explicit in that letter. This was before the veto on PFAS, and said, Governor, if you're serious about this, sign the bill.
So, Jesse, my impression has been the PFAS money, the big hang-up seems to be this innocent landover provision. And what that refers to is people who didn't put the PFAS contamination on the property. It's discovered who should clean it up. And there's a dispute over whether the way the bill was written would protect maybe bad actors. Republicans say, Governor, you're confused. You don't know what you're talking about. The governor says, no, look, I'm pretty sure you've got a poorly worded piece of this language, of this bill. The bottom line, though, is here we are, get to be mid-May. Mm-hmm. The fiscal year runs through June 30th this year. Then we now know into June 30th, 2025. They're not coming back in special session. They're not coming back to override this veto. This money's going to lapse back to the general fund, and then we're going to take this back up the next budget. That's my prediction. Not a very aggressive one, I'm going to add. But why is there no pressure to release this money, do you think, or nobody really kind of crying out, other than people in the Capitol?
Sure. I mean, there's people in the Capitol. There's also, you know, people in the communities who are affected by this obviously want to see some action, anything really, to alleviate these problems. But we've been dealing with this for years now, and it's not really cost anyone their seat. It hasn't caused a whole lot of political problems for people for the lack of action. You know, looking back to a few sessions ago, I think we got the closest we were ever going to get to something on this with John Nygren and Dave Hansen working together on an agreement. And, you know, when that fell apart, I don't think we've ever gotten that close again. And, you know, it's frustrating for people in those communities, but it doesn't seem to be having a lot of real electoral consequences.
Yeah, well, your parents lived in Marinette for a while, correct?
Yeah.
So they saw that flare-up of attention. You mentioned Nygren. He felt some, not to say heat, but at least some pressure about PFAS back in that session. But now, think about, like, where PFAS are, right? So, yes, we've got some La Crosse, mm-hmm. Marinette, some in Madison, a couple other pockets, but they're not affecting people who are worried that if we don't release this money, it's going to cost me an election. So my calls, that's what I keep hearing, is like there's no political pressure. Mark Bourne and Howard Markline aren't feeling heat about this. So they see this as we're not going to give the governor this carte blanche to spend the money. We have to have a plan. We don't trust you, essentially. And so we sit here yet again with a standoff, much like a couple years ago with repealing personal property tax. They could not quite get the language agreed to. It took an extra budget. So maybe next budget it'll get done. All right. So because of these actions, they play into our next topic, which is about Democratic ads. So we've got some spending going on. I know it's only been May, but November is just around the corner, 6 months and counting. The faster it comes, the better, I think, for both of us. But let's look at these ads from SSDC, the Senate Democratic Committee, targeting seats this fall. You have $550,000 in 32nd Senate District, which is where Brad Path is defending him, $2.1 million in the 8th Senate District, $1.3 million in the 14th Senate District, $1.1 the open 18th, and $1.9 the 30th. So if we run down the candidates there, Jesse, in the 8th, we've got Dewey Strobel, who's drawn to that seat, much more of a swingy seat than it was before. His one was much more Republican. Jody Habesh-Hennigan running again if we're in the special election last year. Now the 14th, Joan Ballweg. That's her seat on the number. It's massively reworked from her old seat, about two-thirds new territory. She's running there, a couple of Democrats in that race. The 18th, an open seat, pretty good Democratic one in the numbers right now, runs along Lake Winnebago, from Oshkosh to Appleton. Probably on the numbers, the best pickup opportunity for the Democrats. Then the 30th, $1.9 million. That one, kind of open. There are three Republicans there to start, two have moved. Well, one's retiring, one's moved, and one's running for Congress. Mm-hmm. When I ask people about this, the numbers reflect both priority and market costs. So the 8th is in the Milwaukee media market, expensive. The 30th, Green Bay, is going to be jam-packed with ads this fall because it's Green Bay.
Yeah.
What do you see? Why the spending now? Is this just a marker to kind of, like, warn Republicans are coming for you?
I think so. I mean, they're making a point of noting, you know, they're fielding more candidates than ever really before. They're spending all of this money more than before. I think it's a little bit probably of a, you know, a fish shake of, hey, look at how much money we have. Like, you guys should be scared. you know, knowing the kind of the financial problems that, you know, Republicans have had, I think there's a little bit of just drawing that contrast. And also, you know, everything starts earlier and earlier every year, right? You know, you try to take advantage of this open space before the national races get even louder.
I took a peek at the SSDC campaign finance report from mid-January for the end of December. They had $225,000 in the bank. They're not paying for this with that. This is a sign of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin's its fundraising prowess. They've done a great job taking unlimited contributions, especially from out-of-state donors, and then funneling to other people. this money is going to keep flowing through the party down to the state Senate. A reminder to people at home, with the new maps, the Senate unlikely to flip this fall, barring a major, major miracle. Mm-hmm. The best hope for Democrats is get down to 18-15 probably, and then go back in 26. But this is, to me, it's a big marker of we have the money, we're coming after these seats, and more is going to come. Mm-hmm. Piggybacking off of that, the state Democratic Party also announced a six-figure digital campaign this week targeting joint finance members about PFAS, about hospital money, about opioid funds. Just a coincidence, I'm sure, Jesse, but the targets include Joan Balwig of Markazan, Howard Markland of Spring Green, Deuce Strobel of Saukville, Eric Wimberg of Green Bay, Reps Mark Bourne of Beaver Dam, Jesse Rodriguez of Oak Creek, and Shannon Zimmerman of River Falls. Of this list, Howard Markland's not in the ballot this fall, but he's in a pretty Democrat district for 2 years from now. Mark Bourne's not in any trouble. Jesse Rodriguez has not announced what she's going to do yet. Shannon, his seat, leans Republican. He probably okay. All the rest of these, Joan, Dewey, like, they're targets.
Yeah.
Eric's not so much. He's moving over a Republican seat. So it's coincidence, right, that this is happening?
Of course.
Okay. All right. I just wanted to ask to make sure.
I think you're reading that right.
Okay. I wasn't reading into things. Okay. Let's go. Another joint committee, joint audit committee this week, approves a DEI review, diversity, equity, inclusion. Mm-hmm. This was telegraphed by Robin Voss back in December. He said, we are going to use the audit bureau to target DEI and root it out, I think were the words that he used, from state government. Now, the question is how. We'll get into that in a little bit. But first, here's some video from the hearing this week with Eric Wimberger, who chairs the audit committee, and Tim Carpenter, longtime Democratic lawmaker and member of that committee.
DEI is a neo-Marxian philosophy meant to pit one socially constructed class against another. When the identities in DEI relate to race or ethnicity, it is nothing short of rebranded ethnic nationalism. I've not given up on a colorblind society. I choose to see others as peers who happen to have inconsequential physical traits, and not as an intersectional mix of immutable characteristics for social management.
We're just 5 months, 6 months away from an election, and I see this as nothing more than trying to drag up a boogeyman to try and get people to think a specific way. And you're going to hurt veterans, you're going to hurt foster kids, anybody that wants to have an opportunity to get ahead. The governor is making a statement here.
So, Jesse, before this hearing, there was an overview prepared by the Legislative Audit Bureau about what their review would include. It's cabinet-level agencies, Department of Justice, Department of Public Instruction, UW System, State of Wisconsin Investment Board, and Department of Employee Trust Funds. What are you watching for, one, from this audit, and two, what's your takeaway from the hearing this week?
Well, I mean, the hearing, I think, just further displayed that this is going to be a political issue that divides the parties, that, you know, Republicans see this as kind of a cultural issue that is resonating with voters, and Democrats, you know, are kind of losing the battle on that right now, at least from the policy perspective. DEI initiatives have been a huge priority for the governor and, you know, everything that he's done in his budget. We saw the fight over this at the UW system, where they basically agreed to cut some DEI programming in exchange for, you know, position funding and the engineering building. So it's proof that this is an issue that, you know, legislators are going to keep fighting over. But in terms of the actual audit itself, it's going to be a massive undertaking, I think, was the takeaway. Joe Christman, the director of the agency, said this is probably going to go into 2025. This isn't going to be done quickly. Okay. And so I think we can expect that this is going to carry over into the next budget cycle as a result of that.
I think they want it back, though, by May of next year.
Yeah, we'll see.
So what I'm kind of watching for with this process is, so we know Robin Voss, assuming he's back next session, obviously there's a recall out there hanging out right now and a primary possibly get through, but if he's still the Assembly Speaker, he wants to target DEI. The question is how, right? So in state government, the governor has a very powerful veto pen. The legislature can set spending levels and set employee levels in agencies. It can't do it at UW. It has basically no position authority with UW. Can't go in and cut individual jobs. It can put policy in or propose them, but governor can veto them. But with the agencies, how are they going to attack it? Are they going to lower the spending for each agency, lower the number of jobs by the number of DEI jobs they find? Like, how is that going to work? And what can Evers get around that once he uses veto pen, which we assume he'll be active again next year if it's a Republican legislature once again next year? So moving on, want to talk one more topic looking ahead to this coming week. So the Supreme Court has taken a lot of election stuff, Jesse, and our first real taste of it's going to be on Monday. Oral arguments, Priorities USA versus WEC. So this case is basically trying to reverse the drop box decision of the Supreme Court from just 2 years ago. Yes, interesting. I think we both know how this case is going to go if we want to read the tea leaves, but what's your guess on where it's going to go and what should we watch for on Monday?
Well, gosh, it sounds familiar, revisiting a case from 2 years ago. I guess we could look to the redistricting arguments for a little prediction there. I think we've watched this issue make its way through every level of the courts, including the state level. Knowing the makeup of the court now, probably going to be more favorable toward that reversal.
So you think they can just dust off the minority or dissenting opinion from the 2 years ago and like rework it for the majority opinion?
Why not?
Arguments, I mean, I'm going to guess that Rebecca Bradley is going to say, why are we here? Mm-hmm. The stare decisis, precedent, we should not be going back on precedent from 2 years ago. Nothing's changed to reverse this. The liberals are going to argue, actually, we got it wrong 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. That'll be fascinating. But it's one of several cases I'm watching to see how it impacts election administration. This fall, we both watched the Elections Commission for a number of years. Not a very effective agency at times setting policy because they can't agree. So I feel like the courts are going to be the place where things are decided quite a bit for this fall and how elections are run in Wisconsin.
Yeah, and that's the tough thing is everything's on a deadline, right? I mean, you need to have this stuff in place, ideally already.
Well, that reminds me, the court agreed last week to take this case with this Racine mobile voting ban, right? And in the decision, if you look at like the timeline, they're talking about like possibly fall having decision, like early fall having, that's right up against, you know, when people are actually voting. That's going to be fascinating to watch. There's a principle in the federal courts about not changing things too close to an election. Will that hold back the court this fall? I don't know. But again, if they're taking this case, we kind of feel like we know where they're going to go with it. Not that we're cynics, mind you, but
not
just kind
all.
Of guessing.
Moving just on to around a little bit.
Yes. Moving on to stock picks. Rising this week, Senate ad spending. So I'm a dork about ads. I fully admit that. We subscribe to Ad Impact at WisPolitics. It tracks ad spending. Back in 2022, $227 million for one Senate race. I know. It's a lot. We're not there. Mm-hmm. We're not necessarily going to get there anytime soon, but we're picking up. And checking the ad buys, there's One Nation, which is a conservative group, spent about $7 million in change 2022. They laid down $3.8 million for this fall. There's a Fix Washington PAC that's largely bankrolled by Eric Covey's brother, or has been to date, mm-hmm. laid down their $1.5 million this week. And checking the ad impact numbers, we're still south of $50 million reserved between now and November. What I'm watching is where do we fit in the pecking order come Labor Day-ish. Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader of the U.S. Senate, did an interview with Politico last week saying that his priorities were Ohio, Montana, Pennsylvania, and Maryland. So Maryland's kind of the odd one out, right? Mm-hmm. Blue state, but a former Republican governor running.
Yep.
We're not in that top tier yet. My impression's been if we have polling around Labor Day that says that we're tight, we might get there. Then the spending might come to get us up to what we had in 2022. Should note that the poll this week from Quinnipiac had Baldwin up 12 points. I felt like that was a little bit optimistic for Democrats. Did you?
Yes, I did. I mean, not to diss Quinnipiac, but they're, you know, a little lower on the accuracy rankings compared to like a Marquette or some of the other ones that we're used to following. So I would take that one with a grain of salt.
Yeah, is it an outlier or a harbinger of things to come? I see more polls that are in line with that, but Biden up 6 points head-to-head, that was kind of a surprise as well. But anyway, with Senate spending, I should have bought a TV station a long time ago in Wisconsin. it would have made a lot more money. Knicks this week, Cavalier Johnson, the Milwaukee mayor. Look, he is removing Claire Woodall, the head of the Elections Commission for the city of Milwaukee, at a really odd time. What everybody's wondering is why now and why? So let's talk about why now. It's 6 months out from election. We know Milwaukee's in the eye of the storm every time we have a high-profile election. Central count, where they count absentee ballots, is always like this source of controversy for Republicans because it counts late in the night. So why now? There's that question. And two, why? All we've heard from the city is that there were reasons, including she wrote a job description for a community outreach position 11 months ago, offered a job a week ago, she turned it down. okay, well, what else is going on? So we both talk to people in this job. We hear rumors. We can't talk about rumors. But there's definitely a hint of there's a personal thing, a person, either a personnel or a personal, mm-hmm. I got that enunciation correctly, or both, going on here. Now, my downsides for the mayor are, okay, you've got a staff that's blindsided. You've got an election in 6 months. And you've got the likelihood Claire's going to court. Like, if you get fired from a government job like this, usually you retain a lawyer and go explore your options. What am I missing, if anything, in this dynamic?
That's the big question, right? Like, we hear things. I'm sure we'll learn more as time goes on. But, you know, the why now is the more immediate, more pressing question. And, you know, if this goes well and the election runs smoothly, then everything's good. But if not, I mean, if people are going to be looking back at this decision and saying, why did you do that?
Yeah, excellent point. If it goes well, nobody's going to worry about it whatsoever. If it doesn't go well, this is a lot of stuff on his shoes early in his first full term as mayor. Following the nomination process. So bear with me for a second. It's a long story, but my stories often are. But we both have lived through the Elections Commission drama. So this summer, there was that whole, last summer, a whole vote where the Democratic members of the Election Commission abstained from the vote on Megan Wolf, saying, we don't want to vote on this. We are going to abstain. Therefore, she's going to remain Elections Commission Administrator indefinitely. Then we had one of the Democratic commissioners who was nominated to fill that spot was rejected by the state Senate as retribution for not voting on Megan Wolf. So there's your backstory. Now, Marge Bostelman, the clerk for Republicans on the Elections Commission, state law says the leaders of the two major parties in each house are supposed to prepare a list of three individuals. That's in the law. Three individuals. The governor then picked from one person to nominate to the Senate for confirmation. Last week, Devin Lemieux and Robin Voss sent a letter to Governor Evers with Marge Bostelman's name on it three times. Now, I'm not a lawyer. I'm sure a lawyer argued that that counts as three individuals. But it underscores kind of like the broken process we have right now in Wisconsin with the nomination process. We've seen it. They've rejected more of Governor Evers' nominations since he's become member than had been the previous 40 years by like five times, right? Mm-hmm. Here you had the Elections Commission. I'm kind of wondering, like, why do this? The best answer I've got so far is tit for tat. Like, the Democrats are going to vote on Megan Wolf, then we're not going to give you any discretion, Governor Evers, on who our clerk nominee is going to be. We're going to do this. Now, here's the thing. What's the downside? Is Governor Evers going to sue over this? Okay, if he says I'm not going to participate in this, I'm not going to nominate Marge because you've basically ignored the process. She's a holdover appointment, just like Megan Wolf, right? So she stays there. She's still their pick. Oh, by the way, Marge is running some gruff from Republicans because she actually has not embraced the Donald Trump steal theory,
right.
Conspiracy theory. So the Green Lake County GOP, where she's from, actually passed a resolution to boot her from the party, say she's not a member of us anymore. So maybe it saves her any gruff from Republicans, but the bottom line is she stays, and Republicans are finding ways to kind of meet the letter of the law, maybe, but not the spirit. Oh, by the way, the same time this is going on, back in December, the Tommy G. Thompson Center Leadership Board, again, three names to pick two from. Devin Lemieux just sent two names, said the heck with it. I'm giving you two names, that's it. Robin Voss sent his name because he's on the board right now,
sure.
And Scott Jensen's twice. So there's your three from Robin Voss, the Tommy G. Thompson Leadership Board. Again, it seems like we're at a broken process, a broken system, and the two sides are so unwilling to work with each other. This is where we end up.
Yeah.
So that's my takeaway from that. Great. Well, thanks for watching Rewind. I'm J.R. Ross.
I'm Jesse O'Poyan.
That's Rewind for May 10th. Emily back in the chair here next week. I'll be back over there where I belong for the next episode. Thanks for watching.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.